Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Digiday podcast. I'm your co-host, Kamika McCoy, senior marketing reporter here at Digiday.
And I'm Kaylee Barber, media editor at Digiday.
Kaylee, we've made it through. I say this every week. We've made it through another week.
I know. And it's funny because these episodes come out on Tuesday. So people are just like, you guys, it's not the right day for this conversation. But alas, we record this on Friday, everyone. So yes, another week is done.
That's actually a little bit evil. You're like, the week is just starting. It's Tuesday. You're listening to this. And we're like, happy Friday.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
So sorry. Anyways, here's something juicy that we literally just published, which is that Meta is rolling out ads on Threads, which I know people have been waiting on pins. Well, marketers have been waiting on pins and needles. I don't know if the general public has, given I don't know how much the general public is using Threads. Do you use Threads?
I do not. I tried it. I will caveat that with saying I barely use Twitter/X for regular posting. It's not something that I've ever felt really good at, especially if you go back in my archives to high school me and it's just me complaining about homework. It's not a platform I'm very skilled at using. So no, I have not been using Threads. However, I do wonder how users of the platform, I feel like it was like one of the last platforms that is not bogged down with ads. Like, it's an ad-free space. So I kind of wonder how general users will feel about the introduction of ads. But I am sure marketers are excited.
Yeah, I almost, well, we've got a while. It'll be the second half of the year, or as early as the second half of the year when it's expected. But my curiosity is, like, Threads has almost positioned itself, I'm not going to call it a made for advertising site, but with this algorithm has positioned itself to be extremely brand friendly, right? Mm-hmm. Brand safe. I think they've said before that they're not prioritizing like politics and things like that. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, as going into this political season, that tease marketers up very nicely for an opportunity to advertise in brand safe spaces.
Yeah, I do think, like, I was chatting with one publisher not too long ago, and they were saying that there were certain categories of advertisers that really wanted to be dark by October 1st because they were really averse to being around political content in any way, like election coverage in any way. So I do wonder if platforms like Threads and maybe even Pinterest are going to have a really good opportunity at capturing some of those dollars that are shifted away from news publishers, lifestyle publishers for that matter too. But just knowing that there is a lot of hesitancy from brands in certain categories around, you know, politics and the election. Yeah, I mean, I guess launching in H2 is a good strategy for Threads in that way.
Yeah. Speaking of politics, we finally made a segue that makes sense. Let's pat ourselves on the back. Speaking of politics, your guest this week was Kevin Gensel, Global Chief Commercial and Growth Officer at Newsweek. And one of the topics that you guys had was about this year's election, kind of how what that means for news. So talk to me about what you guys talked about.
Yeah. So I've been chatting with a few publishers about the introduction or pursuit of political ad dollars, political ad revenue this year, and how those strategies have changed or I guess just kind of like doubled down in this year's presidential election, especially because 2024 is pretty much a redo of 2020 in a lot of ways. I mean, from a candidate perspective, but also from like, it's the same kind of like topics of, you know, societal interest that are being brought up. So granted, there are a few more, you know, court trials that are kind of steering the narrative. But so because of that, I wanted to talk to him about how that influences their both their like revenue strategy, but also their like audience strategy. And I think to a degree, too, there's been a fair amount of apathy around consumers staying up to date with political election news. I know I haven't been as like obsessed with following that as I have in previous years. And I'm sure that'll change once we get into like, you know, debate season and actually driving towards the election. But I do think that largely there's been a little more hesitation to kind of fall into that political narrative. So that said, what does a news publisher have to do to, you know, grow audience, make sure traffic is on the up, and then translate that into ad revenue and things of that nature? So we talk a little bit about that. We talk about just, you know, Newsweek in general operating as a legacy publisher in 2024.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting topic to be checking in with news publishers on.
I'd say so. So this is an episode that I'm actually very excited about. So with no further ado, I'll let you guys get into it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Kevin, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Kelly. I'm doing great. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. So I feel like I've been starting a lot of the conversations with guests at the beginning of this year with a question of like how tough 2023 was and how much better 2024 is going so far, if that is the case. But yeah, just curious how 2023 was for Newsweek and for you. I feel like it was a tough year for a lot of media companies, but hopefully turning a page.
Yeah. It's the old "how's it going" question. Well, so thank you for that question, Kaylee. I joined Newsweek in Q4 of 2022, and if you'll remember, in Q4 there was already, I would say, some warning signs on what was going to likely be, and turned out to be in many cases, a bit of a bumpy and somewhat too volatile 2023. I mean, there's a couple of ways, I think, to reflect on it and to examine it, to think about it. One of those is quarter by quarter and that journey, especially through Q2 and Q3. I would say with Newsweek, and the ads and overarching revenue businesses of 2023 performed well in Q1 and Q4. There were some months over the summer, bridge months, Q2 into Q3, that, you know, didn't quite perform to our expectations or to where we hoped we would, to what we hoped we would achieve. But we felt like in totality, we did end the year with some growth, which was great. And again, didn't achieve what we set out to accomplish in the year. But I feel like we strategically started to sow seeds throughout the year that we knew were going to strategically benefit the business, our readers, brand partners, and start to develop other core commercial aspects of the company that we're beginning to see in 2024 and beyond.
That's great. So when you say you saw some growth, was that like kind of across the board revenue, or was it in specific areas of the business?
Well, one aspect of growth, and this is specifically pertaining to Q4, Kaylee, is that we really picked up audience growth both via new uniques as well as engagement. In fact, the Press Gazette, which you likely know well, Kaylee, is a media reporting source that looks at the traffic, the audience, the engagement of the top 50 news and information sites across the world on the internet. And Newsweek, in both December and as we turn the page into January of this year, was the top growing site globally amongst the top 50 of news and information sites. So that momentum of audience engagement, of relevance, and of the ads business that, of course, follows that, really led to growth for us.
So, yeah, I guess the question about 2024, then Q1, sowing the seeds, are you feeling like this year is already in a better position than 2023 was? Or do you think that there's still some possible volatility in that, like, in those middle quarters?
Kelly, there's always that possibility. Yes, to answer your question, though, we are off to a strong start in 2024, but we are off to a strong start, and we keep a humility about ourselves here, because we know every month and certainly every quarter, we're really having to re-earn the attention of global news consumers. We're having to re-earn the partnership with brands. We're having to ignite new business development opportunities every single month, every single day. And so we're excited about the start to the year and with the performance of Q1, but we stay with a growth mindset and hungry and passionate as advocates for our readers and our partners.
Fair enough. I mean, I feel like that's largely the sentiment I've heard from a lot of publishers lately. But the fact that it is an election year, not just in the US, but like in so many different countries, is that giving you any more, like any higher degrees of like either visibility into the year or optimism regarding maybe starting from like an audience perspective? And then we can get into like the more advertising part of the question, but how does some of these like core moments, like the Olympics, election, things like that, kind of help you in like steering out, you know, where this year might go?
Yeah, in this very competitive media landscape that Newsweek exists in and is currently thriving in, we are emboldened, and I don't use that word lightly, I use it intentionally, by our mission. And I have had an incredible journey in my career, having had the opportunity to work and lead some really important, iconic media brands in my career. But I would say at Newsweek, we have complete alignment and unification around our mission across product, the newsroom, commercial, legal, finance. And that is the mission, to seek common ground. And we're so passionate by that. And I think it becomes even more of a force multiplier in an election year like we are in. We believe that over the last 10 and certainly 5 years, that this polarization that has occurred across this country and the world, quite frankly, but let's stay focused on the US for a minute, that's been driven by your newsfeed, that has been algorithmically propelling misinformation, that in turn created or certainly was one of the origin stories for the term fake news. That term was then flipped on its head and weaponized, including by a sitting president. All along the way, creating confusion, creating animosity with the people, with our neighbors, and certainly with different regions of the country, different political, cultural perspectives. I think along with this, perhaps the most polarizing aspect of all of it was you had media companies towards the right and towards the left that saw benefit to almost move from engagement to enragement.
Mm.
And there was almost like a business model around that. And it's like, my gosh, can a media company, can multiple media companies, but can a media company step in and try to represent a common ground goal? Like, we are going to have disagreements. We can do that civilly. We can represent diverse voices and perspectives, not just political, but cultural too, on the same platform. Can we invite that, actually covet it? And all of that from this 90-year-old iconic Newsweek brand is why I think our audience is growing. And I literally believe our mission has never been more important than it is today, to help re-strengthen the fabric of this country as we head into this election cycle. I was reading somewhere, Kaylee, that somebody said every presidential election, the generation that will be voting will say this is the most important election of our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that, but I do think this one is the most important election of my lifetime. And my gosh, I believe and hope also that media companies like ours can really help be a mechanism that brings people together versus pushing them out into echo chambers or into a polarizing media landscape.
Right. And a question I had for you that I'll ask now, because I feel like it really fits with what you're saying, is like, it is a very monumental presidential election. It also feels like it's going to be a rehashing or like a rematch from 2020 in a lot of ways. So given that it's largely the same candidates, it's a lot of the same arguments that were made back then coming back into the picture now, how does that, I guess, change, if it does, your coverage strategy or your like audience engagement strategy? Is it kind of returning to that playbook that existed in 2020, or in now that you are with Newsweek and you weren't in the last election, is it like, is there a new strategy that you're bringing in to try and be mindful of any nuances that you think are necessary this election versus 4 years ago?
You know, it's interesting when you've just caused me to think about 4 years ago. And at that time, I was the chief revenue officer at Gannett and USA Today. And what I don't think, which seems so obvious as we sit here today, but what we didn't foresee, maybe the newsroom did, so I don't mean to put the words in their mouth, but we didn't foresee was this dramatic Trump bump of engagement, of subscription growth, clearly leading media companies across the sector experienced that. And that was like this revelation, and it was jarring in some ways and odd. And then that fed in, of course, to civil unrest and COVID, which was just really built news cycles and almost desperation for information. And this feels different this time, to your point. We treat our audience in general as independents. And in that, we actually believe that the Newsweek audience will likely help to determine the outcome of this election. And that sounds conceited, and we're not conceited people here. We're humble. But we do feel that the independence of our reader, because of the way that we productize our mission, the way that we showcase a daily debate, for instance, on our homepage, we like to take our reader on a bit of a journey out of their comfort zone and ask them to feel some comfort in that. I personally wish there could be a third candidate that we could vote for, someone who sat or seated amidst those two, who it looks like will be gentlemen running for the presidency, whether that's Nikki Haley or somebody else, but who knows. How that will inform our coverage, you know, we try to represent both sides of stories and to tell stories that aren't being told necessarily, and I'm speaking specifically politically. I think that the coverage of the candidates, we're going to stay true to our mission and to the course. The Olympics will bolster our coverage. We actually, just this last week, are launching a whole new area of focus around sports on Newsweek, which we're super excited by. I can talk to you more about that. But I'm excited to work collaboratively with the newsroom as we pursue the stories that will propel and determine the outcome of this election. And I'm also excited that our audience will be participatory in determining the outcome of the election.
Yeah. And speaking of the audience engagement, and I think to your point, like asking the audience to move outside of their comfort zone and be like engaged, like lean in. I did notice on the website, your comment sections are pretty active versus some others I've seen that are like, maybe like, a few comments here and there. But I guess looking at like the audience engagement piece of it, I feel like there's also been a level of apathy a bit around this US presidential election. And maybe this is more like anecdotal. What I've noticed is like less talking about it in such a fiery manner, and almost surrendering to the idea that you're going to vote for someone that you probably don't want to. Like, that's the mentality I've heard. So I'm wondering, like, around audience engagement and then also everything that's happening with like algorithm changes on social media and search and, you know, just it almost feels like a little bit of an uphill battle to get audiences leaned in, engaged, reading, consuming media, however it is given to them, is a challenge that publishers, particularly newest ones, have to be like staying on top of. Like, I guess from like an audience development, audience engagement play, are there other strategies you're kind of focusing on this year, or, you know, the company is looking at to not just like grow, but like, I don't know, maintain a level of engagement that maybe isn't as much of a given as it was, you know, to your point with the Trump bump and, you know, COVID and everything like that 4 years ago?
So everything that you said leading up to the question is 100% accurate. Full stop. And yes, we are doing, in my opinion, some really interesting and innovative audience development techniques that, again, are helping our momentum around growth and including an engagement. As we all know, Facebook referral traffic has fallen off. Other social platform referral traffic has also fallen off. And our audience development team got very interested in experimenting with WhatsApp, for instance. And we've been, I would say, amongst the leaders in US media in experimenting. I don't know where we rank literally, but I know we are partly leading the way there. And we've seen a significant amount of audience come to us now from the WhatsApp. I don't think they even call their product a newsfeed, but it's interesting. And I've been experimenting with that. We also have been leaning into Reddit more and more. And we find that platform is a successful one for a reader journey for us. On the engagement side, if you look at third-party sources of measurement of fairness, accuracy, centricity, like NewsGuard and All Sides, trustworthiness too, you'll find that Newsweek sits right at the center. We've started talking with another firm in this space, Adfontes, who is also helping us. If you know Adfontes, they rate stories on a story-by-story basis, literally, so that you can see where you sit from a trustworthiness and a reliability and where you sit on the left, right, center spectrum. And all of that informed a new product that we launched called a fairness meter, where we give our reader the ability to rate the story and tell us whether it is fair or not. So it's, don't just trust us because we say to trust us. Don't just trust us because we're centrist. We want to earn your trust, and we want to hear from you. And so that has been a great experiment for us. And we've really started to see usage of this tool, which is very light. The cognitive overhead is minimal. And so we've been very proud of the engagement that we've had with that product.
When did that officially roll out?
I knew you were going to ask me that, Kaylee. I'm going to say it was early Q4
okay.
of 2023.
Relatively new then. And
yes,
you're seeing like decent pickup. Is there like a, like, I guess like a larger use case for it, like on mobile, or like, is there like a type of reader that you find really kind of choosing to engage with that?
Definitely mobile. And our sample size is large enough now so that we're seeing usage of the tool across different types of content verticals. So the logic was, when we launched, maybe it would be the type of tool that's more highly utilized around the war in Ukraine or around politics. And at first, that was true. But now that time has gone on, we're seeing the tool being used across entertainment content, for instance. And so, so more to come on that. And we're thinking about how that might build into an ad product of some sort for us too, as we continue to incubate it.
Yeah. I mean, and that kind of, I think, steers into my questions I had around the advertising side of the business, because I feel like first party data or like audience insights is a very critical thing for publishers and for advertisers, especially with cookie deprecation, which, you know, it's spoken about ad nauseum now, but I'll bring it up again anyway. But curious if you could kind of, I do have like deeper questions about advertising, but I am curious how you kind of structure the business right now. Like poking around on the website, I didn't see too much display coming up, but wondering like how advertising is, the business is kind of broken out. If you have like a programmatic business, if it's largely direct, or what's the like strategy there?
Yeah, it is layered. So we think a lot about the layers of our digital advertising ecosystem, which of course starts with open programmatic and then levels up into different types of direct programmatic deals we're doing within private marketplaces, guaranteed deals. Then we move into our direct IOs. And then, of course, at the top of that is sponsorships. And so we have been focused on the premium programmatic, the direct IO business, and starting to build out our rhythm on sponsorships. So an example on sponsorships, one that we currently are in market with right now, and it's interesting and relevant with the backdrop of, in theory, what will be presidential debates. I'm assuming both candidates will debate, but
yeah.
Right, so let's assume. At Newsweek, we are passionate about the importance of debate and civil discourse, particularly as it plays into our mission of seeking common ground. And when you look at, in America, the phenomenon of high school debate, what we find is that students who have the ability to debate in high school are most often coming from affluent households and affluent school districts. And so for us, the process of democratizing debate skills so that all students have access to it is mission critical. And one of the reasons we believe so passionately in this, when you look at the students who have debate skills, their propensity to apply to college, to get into college, to graduate from college, all exponentially skyrockets. So we have started a partnership with a group called the National Urban Debate Leagues, which focuses on students growing up and going to school in inner cities who want to pursue debate. And so now we're starting to tell the stories of these students. We actually hosted students to a debate at One World Trade Center, where our offices are, and just their trip to New York, their experience of getting together just as kids, quite frankly, or as students, but then also debating is so inspiring. We think the community, mentors, school board members, principals of high schools, parents, families, all stitched together into this powerful, important, inspiring, aspiring community that is enabling students growing up in inner cities to pursue debate skills. We're in the process of meeting with an agency partner to talk to them more about how they can work with us in this important story that we're telling around students who are growing up in inner cities, pursuing debate skills, and all the inspiring and aspiring stories behind that.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back. That's awesome. So that's a very like big sponsorship opportunity that you're leaning in on. And I guess like another question I had, and I think it's a different approach for every kind of publisher that operates in this space, but like how with news being a touchy subject for advertisers and the kind of leaning away that some choose to do either through like full out blocking news category or being very like limited in how they show up there. Is this kind of sponsorship like ideal, your kind of strategy for avoiding some of the news avoidance by having like, you know, a docuseries or something that's a little bit more custom and a little bit more quote unquote brand safe? Like, is that a big priority for this year, or how are you thinking about, you know, the role of these sponsorship offerings to grow advertising?
Kaylee, brands are avoiding news environments?
I don't know if you heard, but it's crazy out there.
I have a soapbox mentality on that, which I will spare you and the audience of listeners. Let me just say this. The chief marketing officers that I know and that I know well consume more news than the average citizen by an order of magnitude more. I chuckle, but I do take this very seriously. And I think that brands more and more are aligning with purpose. And that's important. And that's to be celebrated. And I think there's a really important purpose to supporting the incredible, fearless work of journalists who are telling the stories that need to be told, often giving voice to voiceless human beings across the globe, putting themselves into harm's way. I told you I get on a soapbox. And I will step back off of that. But there are realities. And I know that brands have choices, of course, and they want to reach great audiences. They want to do it in a contextual environment that's impactful with creative execution that resonates and ultimately to drive performance all the way through to ROI, of course. The Newsweek brand and the aperture of the brand gives us a lot of permission. So when we dig into audience analytics, we find that younger consumers of our stories, two themes that resonate with them, for instance, are sustainability, which led to a whole content initiative that we developed last year that's roaring into year two called Better Planet, and also different aspects of the new work environment. Like we've moved from home, kind of back to work, the building of culture, the importance of equity and inclusion, the mobile mindset. How do you develop culture? How do you recruit talent? How do you retain great talent? Build camaraderie, all of that. So that led us to explore a really interesting content initiative that we call Better Workplaces. That was a content theme that had been developed by a partner of ours on LinkedIn. And her name is Dori Clark, amazing woman. And so she's come now to Newsweek to help sit down with authors, with executives, to talk to them about these issues. So it's like we're picking up signals in story-level data that are relevant to different segments of audiences who come to Newsweek because we're large. And then we identify themes that we can further sculpt and explore to drive engagement, in some cases subscription or membership, which I'm happy to talk to you about, and certainly areas that brands can partner with us in. And yes, I would say these are non-news. Yes, I would say they're brand safe, but we view them as more strategic than that too. But yes, you're at the essence of your question, yes, you're right. But we have a thought process behind it.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense. I think also with how I've been talking to, or like what I've heard from publishers too, is this idea of like having niche expertise that is used to also win business with, you know, various advertisers and things like that. And I think that vertical strategy kind of fits into that to a degree as well. And you also mentioned leaning into sports this year and building out more coverage there. I guess like how are these vertical approaches working towards building up ad revenue so far this year? Like, have you like been able to, win more direct business because of like, you know, either brand takeovers of these verticals or, you know, entering new conversations with clients that you previously weren't able to work with?
Definitely. It's up-leveling conversations. It's enabling us to have really strategic and smart conversations with marketers, with senior level executives at agencies. You know, with Newsweek over the last 18 months, we've been out in the marketplace reintroducing Newsweek, re-inspiring Newsweek, imagining it, creating the innovation layer to who our audience is, what the brand means today in 2024. And when I say introducing it, we're introducing it to some members of the advertising marketplace who weren't even familiar with the printed format of Newsweek. And we're getting them excited by it. And so there's a really important open programmatic layer, as we discussed. Then there's a tactical yet important premium programmatic layer. But these types of sponsorship opportunities and content strategies, when they weave together with product innovation, they just create this inspiring opportunity for brands to partner with us. And, you know, we've had some success with this, and we expect to have a great deal more in 2024.
In terms of like the political vertical, do you do any, like take any political advertising dollars, or is that a category you try to steer away from?
I have a lot of experience with political advertising, and what I have found over the last couple of cycles is that it's so battleground state focused. And even with some of the targeting capabilities of the platform, you're getting really low level. I mean, you're getting to undecided battleground state, certain zip code. So that's Facebook's domain, quite frankly. Now, Does a media company with a platform like Reach, Newsweek, and others in our space, do we have access? Sure. Do I think it will be huge for us this year? It remains to be seen. Usually what is a bit bigger, Kaylee, in my experience, are campaigns that ride alongside an election cycle. So that could be advocacy, but advocacy comes in different shapes and sizes too. There are brands we're working with right now, by the way, who want Washington, D.C. Reach big time. Now, that's different than the actual election, but that's wanting a voice in the Beltway right now. And so we've been in partnership conversation with partners there for sure. So I think there will be an uptick in revenue because of the election. It remains to be seen by how much.
That's fair. And I think that's a conversation I've been having with my colleague, Sarah Guaglione, who's covering kind of where, honestly, like political ad dollars are going. And it does seem like it's a very local approach. So that definitely makes a lot of sense. Okay, interesting. And so I mean, because we're already like a half hour or so into this conversation, I do want to talk about like membership, subscription, and reader revenue, and kind of going along with our conversation that we were having around audience engagement. I'm curious how you're thinking about subscription revenue as like a line item this year, if it's something that you can see growing, especially with all the coverage going on about, you know, major world and national events. But generally speaking, how, like, if there is any kind of like bump going on from this election in terms of like people being willing to pay for news.
So think about subscription all the time, as do a lot of my peers across the industry. Have you ever gone in, by the way, to your own ecosystem and done an autopsy on the number of things that you subscribe to? I mean, it's amazing, right? How many subscriptions that we each have. So I mentioned that because I think it's important to have specificity and clarity on your intentions in building a subscription business. I also think that there is a role and an importance for content to be free, so that there's equity to content. That's very important. That subscriptions, I think unintentionally, but still prohibit equitable consumption of important content. So we've been, anyway, to answer your question more specifically, we've been thinking about some of the opportunities that we have to build out new financial relationships with readers or members of our ecosystem. So a big priority for us this year is developing, almost call it real estate development, of our rankings, the Newsweek rankings, which are authoritative, which are coveted, which are driven from a data and analytics standpoint by a third-party partner. And so let's take, for instance, our ranking of the world's top hospitals. Well, executives within that hospital are very proud to be ranked within our world's top hospital list. It's consistently shared on social, proudly shared on social. Badges are purchased. It's on the logos for these hospitals. So we started to think there could be an opportunity to build community with the CEO, for instance, of hospitals that are ranked on the world's top hospital list, including perhaps a membership model. So we're early days on this, and maybe next time you and I get together, we can talk more about it. But that's an approach that is intentional. It's almost surgical to go to the hospital analogy. It's a new business for us to develop and incubate and test and figure out. And so I think that's a way that we feel that we can build out a membership model with a specific niche person. And if that works, that could lead us to testing even more in that space. From more of a converting the reader into subscriber model, we're also testing different types of unique content that would be created by some of our editorial voices that would be part of a subscription that's compelled by that journalist almost. And that's not new per se, but we feel like we've got some journalists with really loyal followings who are developing super interesting content, including pertaining to the election, by the way, Kaylee, that we're also starting to move to some tests. And we call that Newsweek Voices. So more to come on that too.
Yeah. The idea of kind of creating communities and monetizing the communities, is that something that you could see like lending itself to like an events business or like, you know, kind of like a conference for people who have made the list?
100%. It's as if you were in our meeting.
I mean, I feel like my role is as a media reporter is interesting because I've gotten so many kind of like insights into how companies think. So to a degree, I feel like I can connect some dots. But with the journalist-centric subscription models, I feel like that's also something, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was maybe around, might have even been before the election in 2020 that a few other publishers had kind of tested. And is it something that like, I think it was like Subtext was one of the vendors in the space that were creating communication platforms for this model. Is this something that you're kind of testing within the WhatsApp platform that you're experimenting in, or even maybe Reddit? Like, is it more of like a platform conversation, or how are you thinking about that?
No, but that's a good idea. Thank you.
In fact, you're welcome. Listen, this is my consulting business on the side, apparently.
We're also working with a partner or two on this to enrich the content experience the subscriber receives also. But yeah, we think that there's an opportunity here. We're not a media company that needs to reach 10 million subscribers by 2020 in order to be successful. We're operating at a smaller scale from a subscription basis, but if we got to 500,000, that would be monumental for us. That would really move the needle in our business. We'd be very excited by that.
And correct me about the print piece of the equation. That came back, right? You still have like a, because it was gone for a little bit. Is that back or?
It is. To my knowledge, just to be candid, I'm not sure that it ever went away.
Okay.
That could predate me, though, Kaylee. But no, we're very committed to the print product. I mean, it's a core part of the company and our product DNA and our mix for sure.
Yeah, and it's something that came up in a couple of conversations, not a lot. But at the end of last year, a publisher told me that they were actually seeing kind of like a renaissance of print ads and like very much in like the luxury kind of category too, or like auto, but is print advertising
seeing the same?
So like, I guess, is that, and then like other publishers like Dotdash Meredith have reported like declines in print advertising, which I think that's generally more of the case, but yeah. So you're seeing like kind of a return to print advertising. Like, is that product a growth product, or are there still challenges, or I'm sure there's some overhead that comes with it, but
I wouldn't call it a growth product per se. It's not. But I think what you described on the Renaissance side, it also, there's a corollary to records. And I think COVID revived some of these almost, there's like just a wonderful sentiment that that people have towards the legacy media. However, I was just reading an article yesterday about high school newspapers returning to print because the high school students love it so much, and it's tactile, and it gets people off of a device for 20 minutes, which is luxury now. Any time that you can put the phone down and the laptop down and spend 20 or 30 minutes not on that, but still learning, still experiencing content, isn't that more and more of a wonderful experience? I just got back from vacation. I read a book. It was amazing. I mean, it's amazing for an hour to go by and you haven't looked at your phone and you've been immersed in the text of a book. There certainly is that sentimental, even though for high school students, it's not sentimental because they don't have sentiment towards it. But that tactile experience and for brands, again, you're reaching an engaged audience who's deeply immersed. And I think that's important. We've also seen the automotive sector and the luxury sector, both specifically that you called out, have continued to invest in reaching print audiences because they're worth a lot and they're engaged.
Yeah. Interesting about high school students leaning into print. It does make sense, though. I feel like it's like they have a nostalgia for something that they weren't a part of. But it's all like the kind of glamorization of moving beyond digital, because that's largely what they were raised on in a lot of ways. That'll be definitely an interesting trend to follow with how like even like Gen Alpha consumes media in the next few years.
Let me add one thing to that. When we talk to journalists who are early in their career, even coming out of school, I will tell you, when they ask, will my stuff appear in print? That's an important question for them. Like they are so excited. I mean, there's infinite content on the internet. There's edited, defined, and confined amount of storytelling in print. So it's rarer, it's scarcer, and there's connective tissue for that young journalist and her or his parents and grandparents. And that connectivity, I think, is also special too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was on my student magazine at Penn State, and that publishing a magazine was the pinnacle of my college career. It was so amazing. That brings us to the end of the conversation. I feel like that's a positive, happy, kind of forward-looking note to end on. But thank you so much, Kevin, for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Can I tell you, my parents both went to Penn State. They both taught at Penn State. They got married at Penn State. I had a little Nittany Lion on my cheek growing up.
Oh my gosh. That, I love it.
It's pulled a heartstring for me.
Well, we are. And thank you again so much.
Thanks, Kelly. Bye-bye.
Thanks again for tuning into the Digiday podcast. For more coverage of the media and marketing industries, check out digiday.com. If you're not already a member of Digiday Plus, be sure to subscribe to get exclusive content, research, guides, and more. Digiday Plus members also get access to weekly briefings from the Digiday Edit team, including our newest newsletter, The Media Briefing. And as always, please rate, review, and subscribe to the Digiday podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Talk to you next week. Thank you.